Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning into Revolution Radio. It's Tuesday night at 8 p.m., and this is the Idavox Report.
Good evening, y'all. This is Dalamont Jenkins, Christian Perez, and Brian Powers. We're here for the Idavox Report on this day, Tuesday, March 16th, 2021. It started the March.
Yesterday.
March. Hey, we're messing up dates all day here today because I wished Queen Latifah's a happy 50th birthday, and one, it's not her 50th birthday. Her 50th birthday was a few years back, and
So you're complimentary then.
You know, her birthday is actually on the 18th. Okay. Her birthday is actually on March 18th, but I went on Twitter today and wished her happy 50th, and it's going to be her 51st. So I'm just like, I see, this is what happens when I, you know, like follow the herd is over there wishing her happy 50th and all that. And I'm just like, you know, and it's so funny too, because just this weekend, as I was trying to shape up the office around here, I have found like her very first 12-inch single.
Oh, wow.
And this was at a time when I was not too far from where I'm at right now. It was at a time where I used to buy hip hop albums and singles without even listening to them, without even hearing them for the first time. And it was very easy to do in those days because, I mean, hip hop was new. You could just pick up anything off the shelf and it's gonna stay with you for more or less the rest of your life. I got the first Public Enemy album that way. I got EPMD when it was spelled EPEEMD. Audio 2, I got the Audio 2 single top billing. I wasn't feeling it, but it grew on me. And
I remember
there's some that I have at home. Well, I probably don't have them anymore. I think I gave them to Melvin McKnight. That I used to have that I don't like listening to anymore. But you know, the ones that I see all the time, the ones that we hear from all the time, I used to just I'm familiar with just by shooting blind in the record store.
What's your favorite impulse buy?
My favorite impulse buy? Huh. I would go with, I mean, there's a couple of singles. I mean, you know, like Latifah, her first single was nice. The Wrath of My Madness was always nice. But I like the Audio 2 single, but that first Public Enemy album,
yeah,
when no one knew or cared
who they were.
So is that like 88?
Yeah.
87, 86, something like that. Okay, yeah. Wow. In 88 was when here's the fun part. August 11th, 1988 was when I got to see them live.
Nice.
And by that time, everybody was just like, I don't know about Public Enemy. I mean, they sound all right. As a matter of fact, they were opening for Run DMC, yeah, along with, this is the hell of a bill, by the way, along with Stetsasonic, the world's most underrated hip hop crew, EPMD, Public Enemy, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, and Run DMC. That was the lineup. Public Enemy backdrop. They just started raising that, and everybody was sitting there going, oh, who's Public Enemy? Oh, they are.
I remember that was also how that was with the music industry back then. You remember you heard the single on the radio, maybe you heard one single on the radio before the album came out, but you didn't hear anything else unless you went and got the album, right? Because you didn't have Spotify. That's it. You only heard what was on the radio, or you go. And I remember that I went and got And Justice for All, Metallica. Because that was the big deal. They made a video. Well, they made a video. And I wanted to, and nobody heard the rest of the album. And I went out and got Injustice for All. And it's still, I mean, that's a fantastic album to listen to still.
Yeah, but when it came to hip hop back then, they lived off the single. Because a lot of folks just used to go into the studio, do their thing for one song, and then just put it out, and then just put out the single. Public Enemy was already known by their singles. They, by that point, they had Don't Believe the Hype, they had Bring the Noise,
yeah,
and I think it was Rebel Without a Pause. I think Rebel Without a Pause was out by then.
That's Fear of a Black Planet.
No, that was Takes a Nation of Millions.
Takes a Nation, I'm sorry, yes.
And nobody, and they really didn't play, and there wasn't really anything, as far as I know, from the first album, Your Bummer of the Show, I don't think there's anything that they were pumping on the radio back then. But by that time, I was in the Air Force, man, I was in Virginia, and back then, hip-hop that was being played in New York didn't necessarily make it down to us just yet. We was busy listening to a lot of like everything else around the country, because New York would not let anything else from around the country come into the market. It was all New York, and that was it until NWA came along a couple of months later,
yeah,
and
yeah,
blew it up. Which is funny because Ice-T had been out there for like years, and he couldn't get anything going in New York until after NWA just like open the floodgates. And by the way, we got to send a shout out to Ice-T and his crew Body Count for getting their first Grammy Best Metal Performance for a song. Oh, damn. What's the name of that damn song?
Bum Rush?
Bum Rush, yeah. Bum Rush the show. And, you know, we always talking about cancel culture. I remember back in the day when they tried to cancel that band for
Charlton
culture.
Heston and the NRA.
And they failed miserably.
He called it Killer Cop. He mispronounced the name of the song.
And if you, and if, I mean, I like Body Count, but I remember when they first came out, I think I thought, honestly, kind of thought of them as a gimmick band. I'll be honest with you. Like, my impression of them was like, all right, he wants to do something different, and he's just making this kind of one album, almost a goof. I thought it was almost a goof. And if you listen to that song where he's talking about the witch, it, on the first album, and she gouges out his eye, and it's very corny. They
it
developed.
Does it does sound, hey listen, he they developed develop. Like you said, but let me tell you something.
They are so fucking good. The guitarist is one of the best metal guitarists out there, you know. Yeah. And it's just to hear, like, and I just wonder, like, you know, if he wasn't Ice-T, we would never know about these amazing musicians in Body Count. I think it's a shame, you know, that, but they all around as a band, Body Count is, I could listen to them all day now. And I used to kind of giggle at them a little bit, you know? So it's cool.
The guitarist, I should say, the guitarist is Ernie C, and he's been with them since the very beginning. I saw them. Yeah. I saw the original band. There's two members that have since passed away, but I saw them when they played, as Punks for Progress pointed out, they played at the first Lollapalooza.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I didn't see them. I was working at Tower Records at the time. I didn't get a chance to see them at Lollapalooza because I couldn't get out to Waterloo Village, which is where they was playing in that in this area.
But
I was Tower Records was a couple of blocks away from from CB's, and my boy who also worked with me at Tower Records, he saw a quick thing like the day before in the classified section of the Village Voice that said Body Count's going to be playing at CB's for $15. Nice. That was it. So on our lunch break, we went over to CB's, our tickets, saw Ice-T sitting there, hanging out, and I was just, hey, what's up? And then left and went back to work.
That was Stevie's. I ran into two of the Ramones there. I mean, what a dump. It smelled like piss from miles away. But the coolest people were in there all the time. It was awesome.
Hey, when I went to the show, it was like the next day. It was, I mean, I posted this video because I'm actually at the stage while he's singing Cop Killer. And you know, Chuck D was there, Eddie from Leeway was there, and
Leeway, okay, that's a throwback. Leeway's a throwback. Leeway was,
yeah,
it was a hardcore band when America wasn't ready for hardcore.
No, they were trying to be ready, but they didn't know what was up. I mean, this was a show. This was a show. And unfortunately, a lot of times whenever you have shows at CB's at this point, there was like a lot of those bands that were just local, and they were on the bill too. I don't remember a single one of them. I do not remember. But
one of them was me.
No, not true. I'm wrong. I'm wrong. No, hell no. Madball would not be an unforgettable band. But I'm sorry. Blitzspear, a band called Blitzspear, played that set. So that's the only band that I remember, because they're the only ones that came as hard as ice. So
yeah. I love Madball, by the way.
Oh, Madball's the shit. I mean,
Look My Way might be my favorite song ever.
MYAC all the day, all way. All day, NYHC always. So, but it was cool seeing the Grammys. It was cool seeing, yes, Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion Caught Some Hell online. I would recommend everybody, go to Twitter and, just watch how Cardi B is dragging Candace Owens all over the platform. It's just like she warned Tommy Lauren when Tommy Lauren came for her that she would dog walk her, and Candace Owens wanted some of that, and here we go.
Uptown Girls from the wrong side of the tracks.
Oh no. She's putting Candace Owens under the tracks. See, Candace Owens does not like black people.
No, and self-hate is strong with her.
I mean, good. I've never heard her say a positive thing about black people whatsoever. So Cardi B coming for her is just like,
so Kelsey.
And but see, when you want to talk about what black people bring to the culture and black people, and you have folks like Cardi B coming up on Fox News, trying to basically tear it down, can't do it.
This country would be so lame without there is nothing cool in this country culturally that black people did not create. I don't care if it's the guitar created by a Moorish Spaniard hundreds of years ago, or rock and roll, jazz, or the blues itself. You go to the Country Music Hall of Fame, they themselves say that black music is one of the inspirations of country music. This country would be lame as hell without black people. Like
this? Well, thank you. But
it would not exist. It would not exist.
Well, take a look at the name of this report.
Ida B. Wells.
Ida Fox report. Where is she? She should be
right behind you.
Blocking
right behind you.
That woman right there is the reason why I do what I do. She called out lynchings when no one else would. And I call out fascism when no one else would. But see, here's the thing that also comes with me too. I mean, I'm also inspired by people like Mary McCloak Bethune and Carter G. Woodson. These are educators and people who, I mean, I come from a family of educators. Yeah, I mean, I come from a family of educators. So, and I'm a writer. So my whole thing is about educating. My whole thing is about helping people to understand exactly where we, and sometimes I come from. I got to say sometimes I, because I got to be an individual sometimes, but you know, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have our guest on today, because she is putting out a book. She is putting out a book, a children's book that she came to me on Facebook, promoting a new children's book. It's her first book. It's called The Color of Play. And it is something that when I read it, I was like, I have never seen anything written like this before. I mean, normally you do see a lot of books, a lot of children's books that promote diversity, but there is much more going on with this that we just got to talk about. So I want to introduce everybody to Nika Howell, the author of The Color of Play. And how you doing today?
Hey guys, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
How you doing, Nika?
Thanks for coming. Because I am not kidding when I say that this was a phenomenal book. And I say I have a link on Idavox. I have a review of the book, and I call it unique. And one of the reasons why I call it unique, because there's so much going on that you don't see in children's books, particularly conflict. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever, everything is usually sanitized for people to take in, you know, for children to take in whenever it comes to children's books. But I think one of the things that makes your book unique is that you don't sanitize it. Well, you don't sanitize it as much. I mean, it's still a children's book, but there are questions that children have that even some adults don't even know how to answer. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to bring you on, and I wanted you to talk to where did you come up with the idea? First of all, let's tell everybody what the book is. Want to explain what the book is about?
So The Color of Play is a children's book that advocates for diversity, acceptance, and friendship, to just make it direct. So when I wrote the book, I wanted to kind of highlight the different struggles that Black children have to go through that the world is not necessarily ready to admit, or they're so quick to silence. So without telling too much of the story, there's a focal point in the story where one of the Black children, he's one of the main characters, his name is Andrew. His best friend is Jacob, who's a Caucasian kid. And so they've been best friends, but Andrew can't do the same things when they're playing outside that Jacob can. And so that's the conflict in the book. And it comes to a point where the parents have to get involved and help the children understand the differences in culture and the differences in different forms of racism that kids do go through. You know, as adults, we like to think that, you know, kids don't see these things. But as we know, hate is taught in the home, just like love is taught in the home. And so if we can, the reason why I wanted it to be a children's book was because I know how important it is for those type of seeds to be placed inside the home. When those seeds are placed inside the home, and we teach children how to love instead of hate, or, you know, how to accept each other and how to stick up for each other and stand for each other, then that's when they grow older and they know how to address those situations when they come before them, instead of getting to the point where they're adults and they were never trained to do these things. They're more sheltered, or maybe they were just simply taught hate. And so I just wanted to create a book that spoke to the differences, specifically within the Black culture. But this is a series, and so The Color of Play, there will be 3 more of the series. And so as the series goes on, I will be addressing different things, and I want to make sure I continue to incorporate diverse groups of children in the books, you know, so that everyone is included. So that was kind of the inspiration, how to deal with conflict. And even the main character, Jacob, he is adopted and he belongs to a biracial family, you know. So I just wanted to just kind of, you know, mix things up a little bit, just kind of steer away from what the norm is for children's books, and kind of touch on the meaty stuff that we often avoid as adults. And, you know, we're scared to talk about these things with our children, but it's things that we should not shy away from. We need to get more comfortable being uncomfortable, so that when our children get older, you know, they'll know how to appropriately coexist with each other.
That adoption part is what took me. I was like, adopted at 6. So it was kind of like, whoa, now you're talking about older kids. See, normally when people do books like this, children's books like this, and it's based on diversity, it's about diversity and all, they always talk about the Black family that moves into the neighborhood. And that's all good. And that's all good. But you flipped the script. You went, I am adopted, my biological parents gave me up, and I'm now living with a biracial family and moving into a neighborhood in Chicago. And I'm like, tell me more. I was like, oh. And you told, oh my goodness, this was so good. It was real good. I mean, this was inspired. Actually, how inspired was it? I mean, was that something that you had seen in your travels that made you say, you know what, let's address this?
Yes, pretty much. So the inspiration, so the conflict portion of the story, it stemmed from me knowing that my little boys or my little girls, my children rather, cannot be seen doing certain activities outside without it being looked frowned upon. And so it does stem from a personal experience. It does stem from, you know, me seeing certain amounts of police brutality or me just seeing, you know, different friendships, whether, because one of my best friends is Caucasian. And so there are things that she's aware of that she knows that she may be able to get away with, but she's open to it. Or a lot of people say woke, like she's one of those where she's knowledgeable about the differences between the two cultures or the two races. And so the book stemmed from a lot of personal experiences. And the reason why I wanted to bring adoption into it was because most of the time when we think about adoption, we see a lot of movies like The Orphan and, you know, all these movies in Hollywood where they portray adoption in a negative light. Like, oh my gosh, this kid is adopted. You know, there's no good is going to come out of this kid. This kid is going to be a statistic and things like that. So I wanted to kind of do a little plot twist and bring adoption into a good light, like a kid that most people probably wouldn't think is adopted. You know, they don't think of most white children coming from those situations where they grew up in a situation where there was trouble or whatever the case is. And then they were adopted by a biracial family and then everything turned out great, you know? And so I want to kind of like throw a few plot twists in the story and just kind of mix things up from the norm because that story is already played out. And so we need to learn how to start addressing the other pieces of the story in order to see the whole puzzle. Otherwise, we'll just still be, you know, at a standstill. 10, 15 years from now, we'll be at a standstill.
Yeah. Christian, you had something?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, was there like an aha moment for you where you were like, I have to write a children's book? why was it a children's book? Can you talk about that? Was it a particular event? Was it something you've always wanted to do? Why this book? Why now?
I think, so let me fast forward to the past. I've been writing since I was five. And it started off with writing poetry and short stories and everything like that. But I've always known that I would write a children's book. I just never knew when. So I'm glad you asked the when portion, because I think after last year in 2020, after between 19 and 2020, all of the pieces of police brutality, and after I was involved in a lot of protests in the streets of Chicago, and even like last year, but before COVID went really crazy, I think the whole world was protesting the police brutality. Like, it was global at this point. And so I think after that, it hit me, and it was like now is the time to do that book that you, I always knew I would write a children's book. I didn't know when, I didn't know what it was going to be about. But I think there's no better topic to write about than to observe the things that we go through. And let's acknowledge that kids have to go through this as well. So let's acknowledge it and let's put it in a children's book. And if the child doesn't quite understand it, because they probably won't, because like Daryl said, a lot of adults don't know how to address certain topics when it comes to race and differences and culture and stuff. But that's a conversation piece that we can put in our families and we can have together. We as adults should not be afraid to talk to our children about these topics that are rough to talk about. And they're going to ask, and they should. Mm-hmm. And so when they ask those questions, that's not something we should shy away from. You know, even if we don't quite know how to answer, it can become a great conversation in families and schools and libraries and bookstores. Like, let's continue to have this conversation. Like, let's not continue to silence these things. Let's talk about it. And that's the only way we can create changes when we discuss it.
How long was the process? Like, from, like, how much time would you devote, you know, per day, per week? And from the aha moment to this book is done, how much time could you say you devoted?
It may seem unbelievable, but what I'm about to say, I wrote this book fairly quick. I would say within a month, I was done writing the book, like just making sure that everything was tidy, like making sure the story was the way that I wanted it to be, and, you know, making sure things came off in a way that a child can understand for the most part. So I wrote it, it flowed naturally. Let me say it like that. The story just really came to me, and it was just like, okay. And it was just coming. It was just coming like page after page. And so what I did after I actually did the writing portion of it, I created a storyboard for the illustrations. Now, this was before I hired an illustrator. This is before I hired an editor to make sure it was crisp and everything. I created my own storyboard online so I can kind of get a picture of what it would look like next to the pages of the words, you know, so it can flow well together. And then that's when I hired my illustrator and everything. And she was like, wow, like this is really helpful that you actually took the extra step to create like a visual for me to work with. And so writing the book was, I don't want to say it was a breeze, because it was difficult, because the things that are discussed in the book are personal for me as a Black female. And so there were some points in the book where I got choked up and everything like that, just coming to terms with things. But the writing process itself, it came natural.
Now, you are the founder of Inked Expressions, and I'm this is a new organization as far as for myself. So I was going to ask you about it. It says Inked Expressions utilizes creative talents to speak life to those willing to listen. Our mission is to utilize various methods of expression to help make the world more loving, diverse, unified, fair, thoughtful, and inclusive place. And this is coming off the Inked Expressions Facebook page. Could you tell us about Inked Expression and what was the inspiration to that?
So Inked Expressions is based off six principles. So it's community, unity, diversity, love, creativity, and justice. And so the inspiration from it came from my writing, in a sense. That's where the name comes from, Inked Expressions. The ink part is for writing, of course, and then the expressions is a variety of creative expressions that we can use to create change amongst other people. And so we do like photography, we paint, we do like design things. Like last year in 2020 in December, we created over 300 greeting cards, and we distributed them to local nursing homes and assisted living places. And in the future, we plan on, you know, doing more things with the community as far as like working with children in schools or doing community projects. I don't know if you guys heard of this organization called Habitat for Humanity, but they're really good with building things from scratch, like homes or ramps for houses for people who may need it. So we plan on getting more involved. But the ultimate inspiration was just that we wanted to find a way to creatively express what it means to be unified. And so we're going back to the love versus hate piece. And I had started an organization in college when I was getting my bachelor's degree a couple years ago, or quite some time ago. And it's kind of like a sister organization to that, you know, community-based, let's be unified and let's find ways to work together and get a simple goal done or a common goal done. And we can do it through creative expressions. I didn't want to take like a traditional route of let's just put a website together, let's put a logo together and assemble and just, you know, do this kind of like standardized model of what it looks like to be an organization. I wanted it to be creativity based and use the arts that I am so passionate about to reach other people. And so that's kind of where it stemmed from.
Right. And it's one of the things that I think is real important, because after last year with all the tensions and strife that was going on the entire summer, I'm not going to say there's going to be a cool down period, because there's not going to be a cool down period. But there is going to be a need to, how should I say, deal with the situations that we're facing soberly. Not that we didn't do that last year. But, you know, things are going to start getting warmer out there, and that's what, and things are starting to pop off. Things could start popping off again. And people are going to start asking, how do we resolve those tensions? Now, obviously, it means dealing with bad cops. I mean, Jason Van Dyke is going to jail, or went to jail, or, you know, sometimes I don't even know what they did to Officer Jason Van Dyke. Was a killer cop out of Chicago, that basically, in many respects, got a pass from Rahm Emanuel, but I'm not gonna get it. but it's kind of like we need to figure out, when we hit those streets and we get what we want, then what? And I see Inked Expressions, I see your work as being the answer to that question. when things, as things are going forward, how do you see yourself as contributing to those questions that are going to be coming up as the strife, as the tensions are still out there? How do you see yourself addressing it and contributing to the solutions?
For me, as an individual, and it may just be a part of my character, but as an individual and as a professional, it's important for me to not allow the world to silence my voice. Because in doing so, my hopes are that I'm empowering other people to not be silenced as well.
Right.
Everybody has a voice and everybody has a piece to bring to the puzzle. And so as we address those different challenges and those different adversities going on with systemic racism and just hatred as a whole, we need to remember the vocalization piece, and we need to remember that we all have a part to play. Like, there's a group of people who would prefer not to address these issues, the group of people who are content in their privileges, and they would prefer to stay in that bubble. But it's our job as the other side to be like, okay, hey, like, nothing's gonna get done if we just let this side just stay in contentment like that. And they need to get uncomfortable, just like we have to get uncomfortable. I think most of us who are trying to promote love and trying to promote unity and diversity, we're already uncomfortable because we are already on the front lines. But we need everybody to join in, because ultimately much won't get done if it's just us over here. Like, if this group of people are just over here fighting on the front lines and this group over here is comfortable and they're okay with how things are, they're still raising children in their households who feel the same way that they do. And these kids, they're going to ultimately grow up. They're going to grow up and they're going to take care of us. They're going to take care of them. They're going to be the future. And so if we could find ways to continue to not be silenced, that would be the best thing for me to do. And I think that by doing that through writing and just by doing that through my organization, Inked Expressions, and by bringing people along with me that are willing to step out on the front lines and get uncomfortable and get their hands dirty a little bit, we have a lot of work to do. There's a lot ahead to accomplish, but we left a lot behind as well. But we got to keep moving forward. No matter how many times we stumble and fall, we have to, the forward movement is important.
And the whole thing about not keeping us silent, I mean, they're trying to silence us. I mean, for all their complaints about cancel culture affecting them, I mean, we just got through talking about the Grammys, and you have them trying to go after people like Colin Kaepernick for speaking out, and you're talking about the efforts to try to stifle our ability to vote. Kentucky's passing a law that says that you cannot insult a cop. And so they're trying to silence us. It will fail, but it all depends on us. So Christian.
Yeah, I was going to say, the people that tried to cancel Dungeons and Dragons and Iron Maiden, the people that invented McCarthyism, are the people that are complaining about getting canceled. It's always the same grift. It's the same nonsense. It's always the same lies with these people. But I wanted to ask Nika, what type of research did you do for the book? Was there any social research you did? Anything historical that you make reference to? What kind of research went into the book?
Most of my research was social. It was related to my target audience, because I, even though it's a children's book, I still wanted to find a way to relate to the parents and the libraries and the school teachers and things like that. So most of it was relating to my target audience, like how the marketing piece, like how to get their attention with this book, how to get them, I don't want to say comfortable, but how to get them to acknowledge, like, okay, this is a very needed conversation piece that we need to have. And so I did a lot of research on the social targeting aspect of it. As far as the story itself, literally all of that story came from personal experiences. So that was just a natural, that was a natural input into the book that I didn't necessarily have to research, because I had lived it in several different ways.
Okay.
Right. But I have a question for you guys. Why do you think there's so much backlash as far as like trying to silence the movement, or silence the movement of, you know, unity and inclusion and things like that? Do you think it's fear, or what do you guys think is the leading cause of people trying to silence voices that are trying to be more inclusive and loving and to fight against the hatred.
I think it's definitely fear. It's definitely fear because you are talking about a country, a nation that has been built on the back, on our backs. And they see us over the past just maybe 12 years alone throwing them off our backs. And we are basically coming up and we're showing everybody exactly what it is we can do, and they like it.
I won't argue. I'll say it's also ignorance, though. And I can tell you, you know, I grew up in an all-white neighborhood, and when I look back at myself, when before I, you know, met such great comrades and politically educated me and got me to kind of understand white privilege, I wasn't taught that growing up. And when I look back on younger Brian, I mostly think of him as ignorant. I mostly think of him as a kid that just was ignorant, just didn't understand people that weren't himself and didn't come from his community. And it took that understanding. I think that's why your book is good, because it kind of takes place between communities, even though it's based in, you know, in one town, it's between these different groups. And I didn't have that experience growing up. And I just define it as ignorance. We weren't taught the realities of who people are and what their place is in our society. We were taught that we were in charge. I'm a white guy, so I was going to be in charge, and that's what I was groomed for.
I would just add that as long as everyday people, poor people, people of color, immigrants, the LGBT community, as long as we're, you know, bickering amongst ourselves, it's easier for the wealthy to get away with low taxes, to get away with economic exploitation, to get away with, you know, overseas, just meddling in other countries overseas. As long as we're fighting amongst ourselves, we're not asking the big questions, right? You know, race issues, class issues, cultural issues, all these issues are important and we need to address them. But in doing so, we also need to look at who has power in this country and why they have that power. And we need to ask if that power is actually legitimate, whether it be economic or political, because those two are usually intertwined.
And that's why they're trying to silence us. We will ask those questions and we're not getting proper answers. So our truth is, if you can't give us a proper answer, that means you don't have a real solid reason why basically you're in charge and I'm not. And, you know, I think I bring this character up, this dude, Paul Miller, and he was a part of one of these hate groups called the Boogaloo Movement. And he said flat out that when the right feels that they can no longer win national elections due to shifting of demographics, that's when the Second American War will happen. And my feeling is, if you're fighting a war over that, one, you're going to lose it. But two, never mind the war, you've already lost by even wanting to fight that war.
Corporate America is on our side.
To some extent.
No, but like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, to some extent, right? Nike is still exploiting people overseas. But if Colin Kaepernick gets a Nike deal, you lost. It's over.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, when the right is criticizing corporate culture, it's not leftist culture. It's corporate interests realizing that there's more money in diversity, multiculturalism, and turning away from hate. Like, this isn't, like, we're going to win because we have corporate America on our side. And this anti-capitalist, you know, I cringe when I say that, but it's the reality. Like, we have the money behind us.
Mm-hmm. And my feeling is too, when that comes into play, and I gotta ask Unika, how do you feel about our future in that regard, as we grow, as we build? Do you think that we are going forward in a positive way? What kind of kinks do you see in our armor? What kind of things do we need to kick to the wayside ourselves as we go forward?
Great question. I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I'm not so sure. Sometimes it doesn't feel like we're moving forward. For instance, perfect example. Technology nowadays, like, it's not that racism is more prevalent now, it's just more, it's videoed more now. And so technology has made things more visual for us to see on the forefront. And so, but sometimes, especially with colored people, even if something is recorded, it's like no one's held accountable. You know, like for instance, an instance of police brutality. So in instances like that, it kind of hurts, you know, because I don't know if we're moving forward. Yes, technology is great for a lot of things, but it's like something that was supposed to aid us in that situation, it did no good. You know, so it's moments like that where I'm like, how much farther do we really have to go? Like, if someone's recording some injustice and still is not held accountable, the perpetrator is still not held accountable for what they did, I mean, what more evidence do you need? I mean, it's things like that. And then there's the other side where I know that people are fighting on the forefronts. And I know that we're not going to get everybody to fight this battle with us and move forward with us. That's fine, because you can never be a people pleaser in that regard. Everyone's not going to be on board, and that's totally fine. We still have to move forward. So I know that there are people like myself and you guys who are out there on the forefront fighting for these changes and these differences and being vocal and not backing down. But it's 50-50 with me sometimes, because it's just like, you know, things keep happening, and especially in Chicago and bigger cities that's similar to Chicago, it's like we see a lot of violence and different formats. And so it's just like, okay, well, where do we draw the line? You know, how do we still see those things and bleed inside and still remain human without being desensitized to it? So it's kind of hard to just be all positive all the time, or you can't be all negative either. It's like, you know, it's this constant battle with yourself, especially as a colored person, trying not to be desensitized to all of the ignorance and all of the pain and hatred in the world, and still trying to move forward.
Now, you said also there's going to be three more books. I mean, two more books, yeah, right? You said it was a trilogy.
Three.
There's going to be three more books. What kind of issues do you see yourself addressing as in those books?
So,
and when will we see them?
So the series is called... The series itself is called Color Me Human. Color Me Human. And I chose that title because I think, especially minorities, I think people expect us to go through so much and to have so much pain inflicted upon us, and then expect us to just be okay at the end of the day. Like, mental health is not real, as if we can just, you know, suck all these things up and still be okay. They forget the human piece. And so I wanted the series to be named Color Me Human, because I want people to not forget the human piece. Like, even all this pain that comes towards us on a regular basis for quite some time now, if we look at our past and our histories as minorities and look how far we still have to go in this fight and this struggle and this forward movement, it's like, don't forget that we're human at the end of the day, and we still have all these layers to us that, yeah, if hate's intention is to peel those layers back and destroy us, yeah, fine, that's one thing. But at the end of the day, we're still human, and we're still going to move forward and everything. And so the next book is called Listening in Color. Can't tell you too much about it because I don't want to spoil it, but that's called Listening in Color. And that one's going to be, that one's going to have female main characters. And so I don't want to leave the females out, because I'm like a feminist, not radical, but I'm really rocking with the females and their power and strengths as well. So it'll kind of focus more on the female aspect of things, and still be diverse in its ways. And then the other ones, I do have the titles already, not going to tell you, but there will be three more books in the series.
All right, you know you're coming back whenever that, I hope you come back whenever it's time.
I'll be glad to, as long as you guys are having me, I'll be glad to.
We will.
Right. Do I have time for another question?
We got lots of time. We got 15 minutes here.
I don't want to hold things up, but I did want to, because a good friend of ours on NJR Live, who's with us tonight, Christian, he said that 2020 kind of peeled a lot back on society. We saw a lot of what was underneath, and, you know, for better or worse, I think that, you know, we exposed one of those major things that's, you know, I don't know if you want to say it's exposed, but came to light because of the death of George Floyd, I think, was, you know, police murders. I think another layer did come back. Another layer that came back, I noticed, was in schools and Zoom teaching. And I, as a parent, I got four kids in high school in school right now, got to observe teachers in the classroom conducting class in kind of a way
that we had never seen before. And I saw a lot of great things. I want to give credit to the teachers that I saw for doing a wonderful job with our children. And I don't name names because there were so many of them. But one of my kindergarten teachers was brilliant. She kept the kids engaged more than most live teachers. But also, what I was also exposed to was the indoctrination, the nationalism, and I wouldn't even say it's the teacher's fault, but that's the way they've been indoctrinated to admire the police, admire the military, you know, kind of back these white supremacist institutions from childhood. I know you address it, of course, in this book, but do you work with groups to try to take on, our public education system or our education system in general? Because your great work alone, can't fix this massive kind of brainwashing. I mean, I heard it. It really is, to a degree, somewhat brainwashing.
Great question. I do plan on working with groups, especially in the education system, more. I do a lot of personal work in my personal life with my best friend. Shout out to Emily. She is a teacher. She is white, but she does a phenomenal job because her classroom was majority minorities. And so her school is it's more in a privileged area. And so, but the classroom itself is more minorities and that her students are more minority based. And so she does an excellent, excellent job. Like doing things for Black History Month. She'll even do things that's not quite in the curriculum and things like that, just to try to educate her students on things that involve diversity and inclusion and cultural things. And I think she's done a great job with bringing other teachers on board with that type of mentality. And she's not afraid to take that walk with us, you know, and she's not afraid to be on the front lines and do these things. So that's why I want to encourage more teachers and educators, even if you're in the corporate world, just more people like Emily to just get out there and take a stand. And yes, you might get looked at crazy by a lot of people because that's not the norm at all. It's not normal for teachers to not be afraid to stick up to, you know, the hierarchy of the school, who are just used to teaching this same old propaganda. And we all know that the history books, if once you get to college or, you know, seventh, eighth grade, it's all propaganda. They don't even teach history as it is. They tell you the pieces of history that they want you to know. And then our kids are screwed up when they get older, wondering, well, why am I just learning about my history now? Or why am I just learning about this now? How come I didn't learn about that in elementary school? Well, you got to take it upon yourself. At the end of the day, your job is to teach and educate your students. And we fail our children, we fail our students every time when we're scared to take a stand for what they really should know and what they really should be educated about. And like Brian said, if a lot of this stuff is ignorance, well, then we're just going to keep hitting replay then. Because if our teachers and our educators and our parents and our communities and librarians and everybody, if we stick into the same script, literally we look like robots. We're just robots. We're just doing the same old thing every time. We're stuck in the same assembly line and we will get nowhere. So I do plan on being a part of that even more outside of my personal friends and stuff that are doing things like that. I would love to network and work with more teachers and educators and everybody who's just trying to get part of this forward movement, definitely.
And that brings us to the question that Ill Will 2020 asked. Please address the school to prison pipeline so that young children can be educated. Well, deep. That's deep.
Do you plan on looking at the school-to-prison pipeline, like in later texts? Do you think that's something that children can understand and handle?
Yes, I think it depends on the child because maturity is a thing, and so I think it does depend on the child. I actually have a personal heart for that population of youth because I used to volunteer in the juvenile prisons with my church. And so I used to go in there and do poetry for them and you know, speak to them and things like that. So I actually have a heart for that population of youth. But I do plan on doing more with that population in the future. I don't know quite how I would address it or anything like that, but it's definitely a conversation that needs to be had because that's a whole conversation in itself.
Let me tell you something. This is the kind of work that my father did. His whole mission was was to get away from the school to prison pipeline. I mean, he grew up in Newark, New Jersey. He moved us all down to Somerset, New Jersey, which was basically the suburbs, but he was always working in Newark just to make sure that those kids did not go from school to prison. They went from school to college or something like, or school to a job, whatever it is they wanted to do. And it used to frustrate him because he felt as though as time went along, all the resources that he had were taken away from the state or from whatever bureaucratic nonsense was going on. I remember him driving past a school in Newark. I mean, when he was alive, we would drive through Newark and he would just be ticked off about how things have fallen apart. And he was, and we drove past the school and he says, I kept kids off the street in that school. And he was talking about evening recreation programs where kids would get out, go to school, get out of school instead of going. I mean, sometimes they would go straight home or they just find something to do that just stayed off the street, you know? Now in the 90s, they were attacking programs like that. So kids, they called it midnight basketball at that time. And they tried to basically demonize the whole idea. But I think the reason why they demonized the whole idea is because it worked. And more and more and more, they're in the position where they cannot stop us from keeping programs and keeping things going forward for our children. Yeah. And oh man, I mean, I'm thinking about, I'm sorry, Chris, but I just got to say, I'm thinking about my father being pissed off as we went past the school. I mentioned it in the column at the time, and it's hitting me right now because I'm thinking about all those kids that were lost in the 90s that could have been here today just doing what they needed to do, you know. And I hope we're getting to a place where there's going to be fewer and fewer of that. But we see today, we see how angry the other side is getting as we try to come up, as we do come up. And we just know that we just got a lot more work to do. We got a few minutes, Christian. Go.
No, I was just going to say, if people of color, poor people, the LGBT community, if we don't know our history, if we don't know how to ask questions, if we don't know how to think critically and analyze, we're not going to ask questions. So piggybacking on what we said earlier, you know, why do we keep squabbling? Why do we have these problems? Why is there inequality? I mean, this is why. If people are systematically underfunded, don't have access to the education they're supposed to, they are going to grow up to be nothing more than consumers, right? And the side effects are the decaying of our democracy, the decaying of culture, the decaying of political institutions. That's just the two cents that I wanted to throw into this. But really quick, Nika, are there any other books that inspired you, book like children's books or young adult books, authors or anything that you felt kind of pushed you in this direction?
Yes. Forgive me for not having the author's actual names. I'm a fan of a book called Little Legends. And in that book, it's a children's book, but the author does a great job kind of displaying all of the minority people who have done great works in the past, you know, inventors or educators, doctors. And so the book really highlights that. And I think that's an important piece to highlight all of the incredible things that minorities have done. On TV, they like to highlight all the negative things that minorities have done or all the negative images of us. They like to pick us apart and make us seem like this monster. And so when I read the book, Little Legends, and there are many other books like it that are similar to it, it kind of caught my attention because that is important for us to, you know, kind of elevate each other. It's our job to elevate each other because the media's job is going to do one, you know, they're set out to do one thing and pick us apart and make us become this monster or whatever. But there's this other side, which is the more true side, the more accurate side, where we're actually creators. We're actually doing a lot of things in our communities and we're actually out there making change. And like Daryl said, a lot of the world, like you guys were saying earlier, when you were talking about music, is built on the backs of minorities. And so I think we need to continue to, you know, replay that piece and that component and continue to infiltrate that in the minds of others. Like, this is who we really are. We are great. We are powerful. We're strong. we're courageous, and those things are important to you know, set in. We need to make sure those things are set into people's minds.
Mm-hmm. And I'm pointing out, no one can really see it, but this whole poster right here is done of a lot of our heroes, and I putting it behind us right now, even though no one can really look at, no one can see faces, but you know, there's scores of that. That this is our history up here. My parents raised me right. I got books like this about our history back in the day in vaudeville and things like that, you know. So I'm a student of history. As a matter of fact, it's history, not really philosophy, but history that actually mm-hmm. encourages my work today. You know, mm-hmm. How is it that we were able to build, and how can I contribute? Those are the two questions that I always ask. Mm-hmm. And to the point that's being made by SoCal Shannon, cops have no business on school campuses. Every time you see a cop on a school campus, that's an overseer. That's somebody trying to make sure you don't flee the plantation. Mm-hmm. And if you try to, something bad is going to happen to you courtesy of that cop. How many times have we heard about kids getting slammed to the ground by some police officer that's on
we've seen it on video.
Yeah,
those are the most disgusting videos on the internet. They're the most disgusting videos on the internet, watching grown men attack children and throw them. It's
bleh. But the point is, hey, they're disgusting. We know that. We also know that they're getting away with it all the time too. But the point is, the fact remains that we are having a problem. We have had a problem going back generations of dealing with this problem with bad cops out there just overstepping their boundaries and undermining our rights and our freedoms, our liberties. I mean, I went to, if you get a chance, go to the Negro Leagues Hall of Fame, Negro Leagues Museum, which is also the Jazz Museum in Kansas City. In the middle, I went there in the middle, there's a picture of the NAACP protesting police brutality in turn of the last century, in the 1900s, 1908, 1909. And I think one of the reasons why you see people like Trump coming up and people that love him flaring up now that he's gone is the fact that they know that we are putting ourselves in a position to finally do something about that. I'm always going to be the optimist. I mean, I love my people, and I know my people can do great things, and we're going to. And my mission in life is making sure I clear a path. So I want to thank you, Nika, for coming here today. And you got to come back. You got to come back. And when those new books come out, we will have you on again. Make sure that we know about your new books when they come out. And speaking of making sure people see these books, when does the book drop?
March 31st. Woo! Right. So it's coming up in about a week or two or a week and a half, whatever it is. But March 31st, it will be on Amazon. It'll be on Barnes & Noble's website. It'll be distributed in a lot of other places as well. So March 31st, you guys can look forward to it.
All right. The 32nd anniversary of me getting kicked out of the Air Force. Like I said, I want to thank you very much for being here, and we will talk again. Ladies and gentlemen, the book is called The Color of Play. This is Nika Howell of Inked Expressions. I want to make sure that we hype up Inked Expressions as well. Give her all the love and support that you can. And until next time, thank you. And thank you for being here.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So, Christian, you got anything to say about all that?
No, I think that was great. I mean, I love anytime we can get somebody on to talk about what they're doing to help kids, to help with education. I think that that's great. I think it was great. Yeah. I think that was a fun interview. She had a lot to say. That was awesome. But go ahead. Are we closing off? Do I promote next week's show?
Yeah, promote next week's show. All right. Tell us what you got.
Next week, Brian and is it Dr. Leticia? Is it Samson?
Yes, sir. Yes, Dr. sir.
Dr. Letitia Sampson, we're going to be talking about political cults next Monday live. Oh, there's the graphic, the American political cult. Reach out to me. Find me on Twitter at Perez podcast on Twitter. Look me up on Facebook. I'm going to be talking about a couple different organizations. If you have any experience with organizations, anything you want to talk about, reach out to me at PerezPodcast@gmail.com. I want to hear what you have to say dealing with political cults.
Yeah, we've had some wonderfully uncomfortable conversations about who we're going to call out on the show, because I think when you've dealt on the left, let's face it, we've all dealt with culty little groups, whether you consider it little cliques within your organization or whether it's outright like weird shit going on. You know, there's drivers behind that. There's individual drivers when it comes to psychology. And that's why I'm so honored to have Dr. Letitia Sampson providing. She's a clinical psychologist, and she can tell us what's going on in the human brain. Chris is a political science mind, and that's what we do special reports on. When we have two geniuses like this come together, it ain't a regular show. It's a special report. So there's our YouTube channel on the screen for Revolution Radio. Please go there, click the videos and subscribe, because this is going to be Monday night at 8 p.m. We're really looking forward to it.
Yes. So this is Monday night at 8 p.m. And I'm going to try to help them up with some material, because Lord knows, Lord have mercy, yeah. I know I got stuff on that.
I want to pick your brain. Pick your archives. Yeah. Let's do it.
Yes. One of the groups we're looking into, we won't give everything away, but it rhymes with mamouche. There
you go. I might come on by, Daryl. It'd be good to just hang out and see you.
Yeah, it'd be cool. And I got my first my first vaccine shot 2 days ago. So
I'm going tomorrow.
Yeah, so yeah, I got
get vaccinated.
Yes, please. We can get these masks off our face. Well, no one's in this room right now, so I can just be me. And so, but now this. So, Brian, do you have any plugs?
No, that's it. Subscribe to our YouTube channels, One People's Project, Revolution Radio, and you'll get the little ding in your pocket, or it'll vibrate and make you feel good and let you know when Revolution's on the air. And then read that book that he's got there. If you haven't.
Anybody that wants to study school to prison pipeline, look up New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. You could also look up Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson. That's a classic. But if anybody wants to study the school to prison pipeline, New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. It's a must read. It's a must
read. Required reading. It should be. I hope that's in every, that's another school book right there. And I hope that they're reading that as young people, because that's such an important book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if anybody wants to try to get a hold of One People's Project, we're onepeoplesproject.com and idavox.com. If you want to find out what's going on from day to day, you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Of course, Twitter is at One People's Proj, P-R-O-J. And then there's also Idavox OPP. And of course, if you guys want to catch me on my own Twitter account, it's at D Lamont Jenkins. That's also my Instagram. And I'm really prolific on that thing. So, all right, y'all. We're going to see y'all next week. I'm trying to figure out who we're going to have on next week, but I'll figure it out. You'll see the commercial on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and all that. So, again, I want to thank Nikawa for coming on. I want to thank for promoting the book and basically hitting me up that she exists, because damn it, we need to big up people like Nika Howell and the work that she's doing, and we will, because we need it. We need it bad. And I think a lot of people are going to learn a lot from her work and her book, which is, again, the cover play is coming out on March 31st. Just check it. Just keep an eye out for it. All right, y'all. Take care. Thank you very much for being here tonight. And we'll see y'all next week, next Tuesday, at this very same time. Guy the Vox Report is out. Peace.